This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Satirist and journalist P.J. O'Rourke used to describe himself as the token Republican at Rolling Stone magazine. O'Rourke has been a lifelong Republican, with the exception of a few years when he was a young man and he considered himself a communist. He started his career at the National Lampoon, where he became editor-in-chief. In the 1980s, he became a roving reporter, covering crises and conflicts around the world. Now he writes for The Atlantic magazine. His new book is called Peace Kills, America's Fun New Imperialism. It includes pieces he's written on Kosovo, Israel, Egypt, Kuwait, and Iraq. Let's start with a reading from his piece, Thoughts on the Eve of War, which he wrote last year in Kuwait, just before the invasion of Iraq.
Not that I disagreed with everything said by the people who opposed the war with Iraq. As a casus belli, weapons of mass destruction did seem like a pair of pants cut to the size of North Korea and into which Iraq was being stuffed. And claims that Saddam Hussein was cooperating with Osama bin Laden smelled of something found on the internet late at night, along with proof that the Jews in a Rotary Club control the World Bank. What President Bush should have said was, here's a man who has been murdering everyone he could get his hands on for 25 years. We don't need a reason. We're going to do to Iraq's dictator what Hollywood does to its has-beens at the Academy Awards ceremony. We're giving Saddam Hussein a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I don't blame most nations for not supporting the United States. The world is full of loathsome governments run by criminals, thugs, and beasts. When President Bush mentioned regime change, hairy little ears pricked up all over the earth. Beads of sweat broke out on low-sloping brows. Blood-stained, grasping hands began to tremble. Poor Colin Powell had to get on the phone to various hyenas in high office and explain to them that America itself was in need of regime change from 1992 to 2000, and we didn't precision bomb the fellow who was responsible, and we only impeached him a little. Kim Jong-il, Robert Mugabe, Jacques Chirac should quit worrying. They should look upon Bill Clinton and know the fate that awaits them is a lucrative lecture tour, a big book contract, and many willing, plump young women.
That's P.J. O'Rourke reading from his new book, Peace Kills, America's Fun New Imperialism. P.J. O'Rourke, welcome to Fresh Air. As a satirist, why would you want to cover a war? You wrote that piece that we just heard in Kuwait on the eve of war. Why would you want to cover war? It's not very funny.
Well, actually, it is funny. The funniness, is, as far as I'm concerned, proceeds from human folly. An earthquake is not funny. A mudslide is not funny. But an extremely dishonest and botched relief attempt after the earthquake, all sorts of people from the caring industries on the take, they could be quite funny. My feeling about humor is that it proceeds from human folly, folly being persistence in error, not just making a mistake. Everybody makes a mistake, but if you persist in a mistake, you then become a fool. And war has got plenty of that.
So what did you find during the invasion of Iraq that struck you as the kind of folly that you're referring to?
It's not so much directly during combat that was amusing, nothing amusing about combat, but the reaction of the Kuwaitis and of the guest workers in Kuwait to the whole war was pretty interesting. The reaction of the Iraqis and their complete sense that they had nothing to do with any of the events, good or bad, that were happening around them, their wonderful abnegation of all responsibility, that was pretty funny. Not everything was exactly funny. Certainly not funny to see the archaeological museum destroyed, but it was fairly funny to see the Museum of Modern Art destroyed because their modern art is even worse than our modern art. And I was with a group of civil engineers, reserve troops from Chicago, who I helped save the modern art of Iraq, all of the modern art of Iraq, it had been locked in a basement at the museum to save it from looters. Sewage levels were rising in the basement. The Iraqi museum directors were very angry about this. They came to the Americans. This is the fighting is still going on at this point. They came to the Americans saying, you know, it is your responsibility to save this art. It's your duty to save it. They almost, but not quite, said it's your fault, you know, that the sewer level is rising. I don't think among the targets that we had in Baghdad that the sewer outlets into the Tigris were high on the list, but never mind. So these civil engineers actually quite above and beyond the call of duty or beyond their orders scrounged up a huge truck, went to the Museum of Modern Art, and began hauling all this very large, very heavy modern art out of the basement. And it was just appalling. I mean, and a lot of, not only was it a lot of it appalling, but it was things like a innocent Iraqi peasant being smothered by an American flag while a bald eagle pecked on his head. And the soldiers just laughed. You know, they laughed. They loaded it all in the truck and carried it away to a secure place.
I can think of a scene that was pretty funny, and that's you bargaining with an Iraqi over a case of beer.
Ah, the thing that gives me hope for Iraq. Because I had said, earlier in the book that Kuwait was basically Houston without Enron, you know, or beer. And so I get to Baghdad. As I say, the fighting is still going on. You can hear gunfire off in the distance. Things are very chaotic. I'm with a group of soldiers that I won't name because this was a punishable offense, what we were up to. We're driving down the street in a troop carrier, and we see a guy on the sidewalk selling beer, which the American troops had none of, were allowed to have none of. And the guy, the sergeant driving the truck, goes, I better stop and check my windshield wiper fluid level or something, you know. And so we stop in front of the guy selling beer, and I jump out of the truck and I tell the soldier, I said, look, I've been covering the Middle East 20 years. I know how to haggle. You leave this to me. Leave this to me. I jump down. The guy wants $1 a can for this beer, which is just a fortune at that moment in Baghdad. And so I go into sort of broken Arabic and charades and pantomime and say to him, you know, how much for a case, whole case? And he goes, $24. His English was perfect. So we start going around. And first place, I didn't have $24. I wasn't carrying much money. And the soldiers weren't carrying any money either. I had a bunch of Kuwaiti dinars on me, which this Baghdad guy was not interested in all. And so we go around and around and around about this price, and we finally come up with a price partly in dollars and partly in Kuwaiti dinars and with some worthless Iraqi dinars in change. And with all the rates of exchange decided democratically by the crowd that had gathered around to watch us dicker, goes on for about 20 minutes. So finally I get the case of beer. I jump back into the truck. I start doing the math, and I realize that I had bargained him from – $24 to a price of about $36. And that not only that, it was non-alcoholic beer. And that's the moment I decided, you know, there is hope for this country. There's hope for this country. You come back to this country in a while after it all settles down, and you're going to find Houston with Enron.
Now, there are funny moments in your book, and there are many moments that aren't funny. And the book, in fact, is dedicated to Michael Kelly, a journalist who died covering the war in Iraq. And during the during the last few years of his life, he was the editor of The Atlantic magazine, and he brought you to the magazine. So you lost an editor, you lost a friend when he died. What impact did his death have on you as a writer and a satirist? Here you are as a satirist going to war to see what you could see, and someone who you're very close to dies.
Oh, no. It had no impact that way. I have never pursued the attempt to be funny because I was a happy person or the world is a happy place. It's my way of being angry. It's my way of lashing out. It's the humor is what people like me who were very small in high school and who got their nose broken a couple times because they had a big mouth, we learned to commit it to paper, you know, rather than making wisecracks from the back of the class. It's all aggression. And I mean, Mike had hired me for my aggression. Mike had a lot of little funny guy aggression himself. You know, it didn't slow me down. It made me feel awful. I mean, just awful. I mean, he had kids same age as my kids, and my wife, a very stoic woman, and I had to call her and tell her that Mike had died. She just came to pieces. And then I had to tell her that because Mike had died, I had to go to Baghdad, because first place there was no one there now for the magazine, and in the second place, James Kitfield from the National Journal, our sister publication, and I were going to try and interview all the people Mike had been with in an attempt to salvage the story that Mike was working on, something that we didn't end up being able to do. But even so, I was able to give all these interviews that I did. People just loved Mike, and I was able to give all these interviews to his wife, Max. So that was, you know, it wasn't wasted time. But as for humor, no. I mean, I guess it was the night after Mike died, I had to go to Bahrain because you could only have a Kuwaiti visa for, I forget what it was. Mine was up, and I had to renew my visa, so I had to go spend a night in Bahrain where there's beer. And I got very, very drunk, as one can imagine. And I remember in the throes of that drunkenness, about 2 in the morning, I'm sitting in my hotel room having hoovered the minibar. And I remember it was almost like Mike was talking to me. It was almost like, because he what happened. He drowned in a canal. He was in a Humvee that came under fire, and the driver was trying to get the Humvee, you know, undercover. And it slipped, and it went into a canal, and it flipped on its side, and Mike and the sergeant major that was in the Humvee with him drowned. And it was almost like I could see Mike standing there saying, just like me to drown in a desert war.
My guest is P.J. O'Rourke, and his new book is called Peace Kills, America's Fun New Imperialism. You've been in an interesting position during parts of your career. You've been more or less a lifelong Republican, but you've worked for at least 2 youth-oriented anti-establishment publications, the National Lampoon and Rolling Stone magazine. Have you felt out of place in those places?
Sure, and now I work for a age-oriented counterculture institution. In fact, a couple of them. And not only do I write for The Atlantic, which has historically been a bit to the left of me at any rate, I'm on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR. We all know about NPR.
Oh, those radicals. Yes, I've heard about them. I've heard about those wild radicals. Yes. All to the left.
That Peter Sagal. if he goes on,
I'm not sure you can really characterize The Atlantic as maybe to the left of you, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, everything's to the left of me, you know. I mean, James Fallows was a Carter speechwriter. That's pretty well to the left of me. So my fate has always been to be the token Republican, I think, you know, and that's okay. Actually, I've had fun doing that, you know. At least you're making a little noise. There's a whole aspect to modern media that, in fact, I just wrote about it in the newest issue of The Atlantic, called "I Agree with Me." It's this business of, well, preaching to the choir, of converting the converted. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh one day, which I don't usually do. I much prefer NPR because I like to argue with the radio. I was listening to Limbaugh, with whom I usually agree, and he's shouting about something. He was shouting about Wes Clark, actually. It was pretty funny. He was going, you know, Wes Clark at that time had just gotten in the primary race, and he's going, well, you know, is he a spoiler for Dean? You know, is he a stalking horse for Clinton? He goes, Wes Clark, he's somebody's sock puppet. And I thought that was pretty funny. But then I started to think, who is Rush yelling at? He's not yelling at Wes. He's not yelling at, saying that Wes Clark is Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop is not going to get people into the Bush camp, you know. He's yelling at me. Rush Limbaugh's yelling at me, and I'm a little to the right of Rush Limbaugh in certain ways. And then I started to look at the left-wing stuff, at Michael Moore's latest book and at Al Franken's book and so on, and I discovered the same phenomenon. He was yelling at the people. They're yelling at the people on their own side. And, you know, when was the last time any of this changed anybody's mind? At least when I'm working, you know, against the grain in some place like Rolling Stone or National Lampoon, or even, I may go so far as to say, The Atlantic, you know, maybe I'm getting somebody, maybe I'm making somebody think a little bit about some of the ideas that are important to me.
Now, I just interviewed Thomas Frank. I don't know if you know him or not.
I don't know.
Okay. He edits a magazine of cultural criticism called The Baffler, And he
I know about The Baffler, yes.
Okay. And he has a new book in which he, it's called What's the Matter with Kansas? And the book basically tries to investigate the answer to this question, why do working people vote Republican when the Republican Party represents the interests of the rich and of big corporations, particularly through tax breaks? So how would you answer him?
I can answer that very simply. Many working people who do vote Republican are aware that there is a fair amount of influence from capitalistic endeavors. They are less frightened of the businessmen and the businesses and the special interests than they are of the government. And the reason that they are less frightened of Walmart than they are of the federal government is because Walmart, while it may sell guns, it doesn't have guns. A lot of ordinary Americans have a kind of commonsensical understanding that seems to elude a lot of much more sophisticated, supposedly, or much more elaborately educated people, which is the thing that differentiates politics from the rest of the competitions in life, is that the people who control the government have a legal monopoly on force. When you have control of the government, you can make people do what you want. Now, it's probably morally we all should help support grandma and pay for her Medicaid and her Social Security and so on. But only the government has the capacity to put a gun to your head saying you pay those taxes for that or you get indicted. You subject yourself to the indictment or you go to jail. You try to escape from jail and we shoot you. Ordinary people have an understanding that there is a power underlying politics, that there is a power in government. And they understand that even when they think the government is good and the corporations are bad. A person who has enormous power over you is somebody that you give a wide berth to, even if you think that's a very good person. You may find yourself a little closer to somebody who's not so powerful, even if they're not so good.
But the current Republican Bush administration is the government, if you're talking about guns, that has led us into a war and is now telling soldiers that they have to extend their tours of duty. So even soldiers who want to go home, even people in the National Guard whose families want them to come home, they're being literally forced to carry a gun in a place where they don't necessarily want to be.
Yeah,
so if you're talking about the power of the government, you're talking about a Republican government now using that power.
I'm talking about all government. The reason that people will tend to vote Republican is on this question is not because they think that the Republicans are going to behave better when they have the power of government than they think that the Democrats will. As a matter of fact, the Democrats will probably give them more in the way of small benefits and so on. But they will vote for Republicans because they have a feeling, especially at a local and state level, that the average Republican is less in favor of the expansion of government power than the average Democrat is. And I think that's probably true. They also feel that Republicans are more patriotic than Democrats, more inclined to celebrate America. And actually, Americans love America. And you can say, well, liberals love America too, but they don't. That they love it the way they do, the way they love their children. It's not a good thing to love your children and simply be blind to all their faults. To which the average person says, "I'm not your kid. You know, the country's not your kid." That's a patronizing attitude to take towards your country. When you take a specific instance, such as the Bush administration right now and the extension of soldiers' duty beyond what they had contracted to do, that resonates with people as an abuse of government power. And it is an abuse of government power. And Republicans are just as likely to abuse government power as Democrats are, except that there's more power to abuse if Democrats have their way. I think the logic is something like that.
PJ, would you ever go back to a war zone?
It would have to be pretty important. I've got three little kids, 4 months to 6 years, and I was very reluctant to go to the Iraq War, except that I felt that this was such an important event, an event that would, for good or for ill, and the jury's still out on that one, shape events for dozens, maybe 100 years into the future, and that I couldn't call myself much of a reporter if I didn't report on it. But I think they're going to have the next one without me.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
P.J. O'Rourke has a new book called Peace Kills, America's Fun New Imperialism.